You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. Thanksgiving turkeys in America used to be different. They came from a wide variety of breeds, they were healthy and raised outdoors on small family farms, their flavor? Exquisite. Continue this tradition with the same Heritage turkeys. Order yours now on www.heritagefoodsusa.com or call 718-389-0985. That's 718-389-0985.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I almost said I'm your host, Taste Matters. It's been one of those days. All morning I've been forgetting things, so I apologize in advance if I make any flubs or mistakes. You are listening to Taste Matters here on Heritage Radio Network, and today we have a show about a lot of things, but primarily about a taste for bacon, and that's how I'm going to characterize it because our guest, Jeffrey Yoskowitz, is, among other things, his business card says, Semitic swinologist, and it's the first time perhaps we've ever had a Semitic swinologist here at Heritage Radio, certainly the first time on our show. Welcome to our show, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Mitchell. Glad to be here. Glad to play that role.
You play a bunch of roles, or at least you have a bunch of interests and passions, and I hope we get to all of them. Pickling is one of them, for lactic fermentation, to be more specific. I want to remind our listeners at home that you can call in if you have questions about pork, pickles, Jews, Muslims, all sorts of topics that we could talk about today. You dial 718-497-2128. You can also email us questions at info@heritageradionetwork.com. So tell me, what does that mean? What are you?
Semitic swinologist. Well, I wish I could take credit for the title, but it was an archaeologist who actually came up with it, who was studying pig remains in the Middle East. What is it? I spend my time looking at pork consumption of it, the pork taboo, and how it affects those who don't eat it, those who do, those who eat it in secret, those who eat it and feel guilty, all the stories in between. And
what is your relation? Do you eat pork?
I don't.
You do not?
I never have.
You never have. But, I love this. Okay.
But my grandfather worked in a meatpacking plant as a ham boner for 32 years.
Was he kosher?
He was.
Wow.
Yeah, so he actually would take those hams and give them to his neighbors, and he got his bonuses during the holiday season. So Christmas hams he'd give to his non-Jewish neighbors.
Amazing. So do you believe that the taste for pork or the taste for bacon is something hardwired in us? Why are we so fascinated either for it or against it? But it's such an important recurring theme in sort of Judeo, obviously, not just Judeo-Christian, but in civilization. Why?
it's one of the things. Is the taste for it hardwired? As someone who's never eaten it, it's hard to fully answer that, which kind of makes, you know, in some ways, my ability to talk about what makes bacon so alluring or pork so alluring kind of difficult. But at the same time, as someone who's been enticed by it for my entire life.
Right. Then not eating it is as much about the taste for it, I would imagine, as eating it.
Yeah, it's interesting, as you know, there's a lot of, if you ever talk to a devout Muslim or Jew, a lot of them would be grossed out by, they say they're grossed out by pork or by bacon. And in some ways, and a lot of Muslims I know, it is sort of hardwired to reject it in this kind of way, to say, oh, I wouldn't even want to eat it.
But then there's bacos and bacon bits and all these non-pork kosher things that always surprise me, you know.
Yeah, like bacon salt, I think, which debuted in 2007, and within the first year, it's just a flavored bacon salt.
It's kosher, smoked
salt, and it flavors anything the taste of bacon. They made $1 million within the first year, and basically people were ordering it. They were sending it to the army. The military was buying it for all these soldiers who wanted the taste of bacon that were missing the flavor of bacon when they were working in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Wow. So how did you tell me about your journey to pork, from a place of no pork? Where did the interest start, and how did you come to investigate this world?
Yeah. It's interesting. When did it start? I mean, the interest started when I was 10 and watching TV and the commercials for Burger King Kids Club came on, and there was a bacon cheeseburger, and you know, I was curious, and it wasn't so much that I wanted to eat the bacon cheeseburger, it's that I wanted to be part of the Kids Club. I wanted to be American, and this one thing that kind of kept me from being a part of this icon of America was not eating pork.
It's the same reason growing up in Canada and watching all the commercials for Cookie Crisp cereal, we thought that would make us special somehow, this crappy cereal that we couldn't get.
Exactly. So then, I vividly remember that I actually went to a Jewish summer camp, but it was a very secular camp, and I was the only kid there who kept kosher, who didn't eat pork. And the kids were kind of sat around my bunk one day. I just have this vivid image of them asking me if Cindy Crawford would eat bacon and want to kiss you, would you kiss her?
Interesting. And, game of 20 questions. Right?
Yeah, and having to come up with an answer to this. And this is, I would joke, and now I think back, but it was this difficult question I had to answer. Like, who am I? The kind of person who would give up on my values? Or someone who is beyond this whole, this children's thing?
Would you? Would you kiss her?
It was a great question. At the time, I said no. I was very resolute. But if she wanted to kiss me, probably yeah. But at the same time, why would she want to do it with bacon in her mouth? And that was the main question.
Of course.
How did I? But then I ended up getting really interested in just food in general and what food symbolizes. And when I was in undergrad, I studied the kosher food industry. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote my thesis on it.
And what was your hypothesis, or what were you looking at?
I was looking at the Orthodox Union, which is the largest kosher certification agency, and looking at its growth in the 1950s in post-war America, and really on how it successfully adapted ancient dietary ritual to modern processing techniques, which was fascinating. And a lot of it is, Oreo, for example. The Oreo wasn't kosher until 1997. Right. This was a huge win for the Jews when the Oreo became kosher. Hydrox disappeared, which was the alternative.
No great loss, but...
which actually was before... Hydrox was about 5 years older than the Oreo. But the Oreo, it took on this significance. But basically, it was made with some pork derivative. I'm not sure if it was lard in this case. There's lots of items growing up. I would grow up with, that had to be... you had to find out if there actually was going to be pork in them, gelatin, marshmallows. Anyone who grew up kosher didn't eat regular marshmallows. Right. They ate marshmallows with fish gelatin.
Interesting.
So I got very interested in, my family would go out to eat, and we would always ask, we would eat in any restaurant, but we'd eat vegetarian. And we would always ask, is there pork in this stock? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about what's in the pie crust? Is it lard? And so you kind of be just getting anxious in general in life growing this way. And actually, when I was writing an article for Meat Paper magazine on the pork taboo, I talked with a Muslim man who owns a halal slaughterhouse out in Ozone Park. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me how his father, who was from Afghanistan, in this country, in the United States, he will never eat in a restaurant that's not halal unless he walks into the kitchen and looks in the back. And if he sees bacon on the griddle, he won't touch it.
Right.
He won't eat anything there except
contaminated everything.
Exactly. Right. Maybe he'll eat raw salad, but that's it.
Right.
And I remember hearing that and thinking, that's exactly how it was with my family. My family wasn't that extreme, but there are families and a lot of Orthodox Jews who will only eat just raw salad out in a restaurant like that. And I just saw those parallels as fascinating. Uh-huh. And then I ended up, somehow I got a research grant to spend a year living in Israel researching the pork industry.
So I love that. Tell us a little bit about the pork industry that people probably don't know exists in Israel, but has grown in the last decades and in fact, you can now buy and eat pork. In fact, when I was there just a couple of summers ago, we ate a lot of pork in restaurants in Tel Aviv and felt a little dirty, even though I am Jewish, but that's something I have grown up eating bacon and pork and various things. So tell us about the pork industry in Israel.
Yeah. Well, first, how was the pork that you ate?
It was okay. I mean, I didn't expect it to be good. Part of the thrill of eating it there was feeling deviant somehow.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting is because there was a book that came out last year, which was called The White Book. I wrote about it a couple of years ago, and it was the first Hebrew language pork cookbook with 81 recipes, of how to cook pork, basically, by Eli Landau. And part of the reason he wrote this book was because pork is just, it's become more ubiquitous lately, and I'll go into that, but he was saying, but we need to cook it well now. a bunch of Jews don't know how to cook this animal that we've embraced, the secular Israelis have embraced it, but people are still
figuring it out, right?
Exactly.
Well, it's funny, I grew up working in a kosher style butcher shop in high school, was my job, and then in college I went to hotel school and TA'd a meats class, but I didn't know a whole genre of animal because of my experience, or a whole side of the cow also, but you do not, you can, it's just not all the same. I mean, there is a technology, a technique to pork. Anyways, yeah. More about Israel. Yeah.
So in terms of the industry, so there have always been pigs in modern day Israel. What was interesting is that the pork industry first really developed in the 1950s during this period of rationing, food rationing. It was just, Israel had just won the War of Independence. It was kind of struggling as a new state. And people were living in kibbutzim. They were in these socialist collectives and starving. There's all these jokes in the kibbutz about how often they ate meat. They would eat a chicken only when the chicken was about to die or a person was about to die. And they would eat 1/16 of a piece of butter. And then suddenly these kibbutzim realized that, hey, they have Christian Arab neighbors with pigs, and they all started bringing pigs over. Oh. And there's all these amazing stories on the kibbutzim about when they would bring the pigs, because they didn't want their religious neighbors to see. So one story, one kibbutz brought a pig from Nazareth to their pig farm, to their farm. They brought the pig on Yom Kippur so that the religious would all be in services. And the story goes, at least as they tell it on the kibbutz, was that the pig escaped and ran into the synagogue during Kol Nidre, the most religious, service, the holiest service of the year.
Right. What a great, I mean... That's a great story.
Yeah.
Right. True or not, it doesn't matter. There it is. It's a sort of foundational myth of yeah, something.
Exactly. Yeah. And so more of these kibbutzim all started having pigs, but they all kept it secret. One kibbutz actually called the pig, put it in the cow pen in the corner, called it lo klum in Hebrew, which means nothing. So when the inspectors would come, they'd say, what's back there? They'd say, oh, it's nothing.
All right.
And so there's all these little stories. But right. Then, people started eating meat, and in this period of hunger, suddenly the pig was almost the savior. So in secular Israel, and especially at some of these kibbutzim, especially the ones that raised pigs and still are connected to pigs, pork is important to them. So in 1956 and then later 1962, the government banned pigs. They learned what was happening, and it became this big debate in the country. What kind of Jewish state is this if there's pork being allowed to be consumed?
Right.
So they didn't ban pork outright. They pretty much banned pork for Jews to raise. Pork could be raised in the Christian Arab regions of the country, or it could be raised for science. Of course, one kibbutz in the south, where I ended up working for 2 months, that kibbutz opened up a scientific research institute about a month
of
later
course.
And started raising pigs for science and slaughtered the excess. And and it's their loophole. And there's all these loopholes. And
it's like alcohol or wine for medicine and religious purposes during Prohibition here. Those things work in your favor often. Yeah.
Exactly. And so there's this myth, though, that pigs are raised on platforms, that pigs aren't allowed to touch the Holy Land of Israel. And that's one of these foundational myths of the country. But for basically this pork industry developed, and Christian Arabs run most of it in the north of the country. There's this one kibbutz in the south, and it just kind of trudged along. There have been, over the course of many years, all these attempts to fully ban pork or to fully legalize it. There was amazing demonstrations in the 80s as the Orthodox government that came into power was pretty much strong-arming the prime minister in Likud to ban pork outright. And so people started looking at pork as the symbol of freedom and democratic freedom. And then it wasn't until the early 90s when about 1 million Russian immigrants started flooding into Israel with the fall of the Soviet Union that a new pork market emerged in Israel.
Oh.
And to this day, there's a huge Russian influence in Israel. 1/6 of Israel is Russian today.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And many of them aren't Jewish, or some of them are Jewish but grew up not being able to practice and eating pork. And then after the Intifada, basically the Palestinian laborers were replaced with migrant laborers from Thailand and Philippines. And a lot of them have this taste for pork as well.
Amazing. It's totally fascinating to me, and I could talk about it for hours. Maybe we'll turn the show into the Pork Chronicles or something. But actually, we'll talk about Pork Memoirs, which is a blog that you have started. We're about to take a break. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. You can call in and ask us questions about the pork industry in Israel, the taste of bacon, the taste of an exotic other food. Dial 718-497-2128. Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I am talking about pork with Jeffrey Yoskowitz, who calls himself, or has been called, a Semitic swinologist, but also not too long ago started a blog called Pork Memoirs, where people are sharing incredible stories, I guess, about this meat that is so pervasive, and that a large, you know, part of the world's population doesn't eat on principle. And has also become to signify a whole other part of the population's identity in some ways. The bacon fest, the pork belly. I mean, you can't swing a cat in a restaurant in this town without hitting a piece of pork in some way. It was James Beard's favorite meat. Does that mean you can't be a foodie and not eat pork? Talk to me about Pork Memoirs and that project and what's gone on.
Yeah, so I started Pork Memoirs partly because in being a Semitic swinologist and doing this research, everyone would tell me their pork stories. Yeah, sometimes unsolicited, I would just get a lot of first-time stories from non-pork eaters, a lot of vegetarians and vegans telling me about times that they've slipped up. Actually, I was just at Fleischer's in Park Slope the other day, and I saw a shirt that said bacon, the gateway meat. And it's true. I mean, based on the stories I've heard, yes, it is the gateway meat for so many people. And then I also just, all these people, as pig slaughters, pig butchery has become so big, everyone's telling me about their story on the farm and the first time they slaughtered a pig, the time that they were in China and drank this pig's blood. And I was just hearing these stories and I felt like I have to, this is a piece of history. This is cultural history being told through the lens of the pig. So I started the website as a way to capture this, in some ways, this look at the world through a very unique kind of salty meat prism. Mm-hmm. And it's been incredible. I started the site, I asked some friends I knew just for some stories and then put it out there. And I've just been asking for submissions and people have been sending me submissions from all over the world. I don't know how they are finding the website or what's compelling them to write their stories down. But
what is the URL so people can check it out?
It's porkmemoirs.com.
Okay, easy enough. And what are some stories? Can you think of some stories that stand out that you've heard?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite stories is one about a woman who grew up in Iran pre-revolution who would bring a ham sandwich to her Zoroastrian school. She was a Christian girl, and she would bring the ham sandwich, and it was the most popular meat there. Everyone wanted to trade lunches for her because it was so exotic in Iran.
Well,
So people were trading pencils, and she says that never did she know that Christianity in Iran could be so lucrative.
Right.
One of my other favorite stories is a woman whose mother grew up as a hidden child during the Holocaust. She was raised by her Catholic Polish nanny, and she grew up eating raw bacon. This is her mother grew up eating raw bacon with this nanny, and then her mother moved to the United States and would serve bacon to this Jewish family, essentially, and it connected her to her time in Poland.
Fascinating. Let's talk about this idea of a gateway meat, and not to share what yet another pork story, but you know, certainly bacon was popular in my house, even though the thought of a roast of pork would make my mother probably sick. We weren't kosher, but it was just a cultural reaction, a visceral reaction to a large piece of meat. Are there degrees of pork that mean something in the world out there that you've heard?
Well, do you know what they say, that Chinese food is so popular among Jews is because they cut up the pork so small that you can't even notice it.
Right. and you can eat it out of takeout containers so it doesn't contaminate things at home.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, are there different levels? For sure. Bacon is something I meet so many people who say, yeah, I don't eat pork, but I eat bacon. You know, or just bacon's not pork.
Right.
And part of it is that, it's so removed from the pig. It's not a slice of meat. It's not a roast. It's this strip that is fried and it's sizzly. It sizzles on the grill and it pops and it's crunchy and it's so far removed from what meat could possibly be. For sure, I think that would be, if anything, the gateway meat or the almost, if you want to dabble in pork but not quite go there.
Right. Allowed.
Allowed. I mean, especially with its ubiquity now. I mean, you could. One of the stories on the website is a female rabbi, a woman who she's basically a chocolate expert, and she's going around to chocolate fairs, and she's about to put a piece of chocolate covered bacon in her mouth, and then and quickly realizes what it is and puts it away. But you know, basically, she probably could have enjoyed and indulged in that, and it would have been okay because it's just a little piece of bacon. And you know what? If it was an accident, it's not the end of the world. Even in as far as Jewish religion goes,
right? So let's move from pork to another P word and talk about pickles, which perhaps is unrelated, except that they both are your interests. Is there a relationship in your mind in what your personal journey is and fermentation and pork? Or is it simply just another interest?
It's simply another interest, although there are plenty of good brines that you can use to cure all sorts of meats.
And the acid cuts through the richness of the meat.
Exactly.
Talk about pickles and this funny moment we're in where, you again, almost as ubiquitous as pork belly, it seems, is the pickle, the artisanal pickle, the pickle made in a basement in Brooklyn, the pickled anything. I mean, what is the zeitgeist of pickling right now?
The pickle renaissance. Yeah. Pickles are, really, for me, as someone who calls myself a pickler, it's almost embarrassing, and because I just feel like everyone now in Brooklyn is making pickles. There's an underground fermentation festival that happens every April in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy, and everyone is sent an email back in November or December to start getting their pickle on, to start preparing a ferment that'll be ready Amazing. By the time for this party. And it's one of the greatest parties I've ever been to. What is this moment? I mean, it's interesting. We're finally appreciating the art of preserving foods as a culture and understanding that some people can do it better than others.
Right.
And somehow the market is allowing $12 pickles. It's people are paying $12 for a jar of pickles, which is almost criminal to think about how basic of a food this is and how it is what, you know, almost people around the world have subsisted on for years as peasant food.
Right.
But we're in this moment where all these basically peasant foods, I mean, Chez Panisse is a restaurant that does peasant Italian food,
right?
Where these things are doing so well. So the pickle day in the Lower East Side, in some ways, which has started about 11 years ago, or maybe a little bit more. And it was a way of kind of reconnecting New York to its roots, the Lower East Side to its immigrant past. And I think in New York in particular, where pickles are, I mean, now I can count about four or five just New York-based pickle companies, kind of hip, new, modern pickle companies. And in some ways, it's people trying to connect to that period of New York history that is so alluring in some ways. The tenement, if you look at the Tenement Museum in New York, they actually have they talk about pickles in the tours. I mean, pickles, it's almost a symbol for cultural preservation. Mm-hmm. And it is. Cultures are what actually preserve the foods.
And one of the things that I've always found fascinating is that when something becomes a trend, as you said, you suddenly are don't want to appear to have jumped on this trend. You know, people have been pickling. I had a funny conversation recently with a journalist who was not a food writer, but was a trend writer. And she wanted me to say basically that you could only find pickles in fancy restaurants. And I said, well, the reality is you could probably find them in a bunch of places in the that you would never go to in Greasy Spoons in the middle of the country who've been pickling before it was trendy and will continue to pickle just because that's the way the food is. Do you think there's something... to me, there's something funny about the retroness of it, and it's related to knitting, which is suddenly a big thing, you know, again, yeah. I think, or probably a little bit past.
And bacon.
Bacon also, exactly, artisanal bacon and pork fest and bacon of the month. And is there a, I mean, do you think it's something real, or is it going to pass and you'll still be pickling? Do you think it's a trend? Do you think there's something about this moment besides just cultural of New York? And it's really happening across the country.
It is. I think bacon and pickles here go hand in hand. Right. I think there's almost we're finally rejecting this culture, American culture of processed foods and this you know nutritionism, this fear of fat. So with bacon in particular, I feel like we're finally at a moment where we're beyond this fear of eating foods that have fat in them. We've bred the pig to be less fatty over the past 60 years.
Right.
You know, people are now eating heritage eating breeds of pigs that actually have the appropriate fat. So in some ways, this is a response, a reaction to. So with pickles, we've been just buying our food and not taking ownership over, not taking agency over our own preserved foods in our kitchen. And with pickles, I like to think that people are, you know, these young people who are really interested in this thing, me personally, as someone who is really interested in making pickles and fermenting and teaching people how to do it, I think of it as social activism, as empowerment, and it's empowering people to know that if they were somehow stuck somewhere in the wilderness and they had found cucumbers, they could make something out of it besides cucumber salad. I'd hope that this is something that will stick with people in their kitchens, and I can't imagine that it won't. I mean, you know, if I just think of my generation, there's an obsession with beautiful jars in their kitchens, with good knives, and once you appreciate these things, you can't go back. You know, once you know how to make preserved lemons and you have them on hand for cooking, right now eating is really in, right?
Right.
I mean, is eating going to not be in as much in a few
years?
Well,
it does come and go. I don't know. As someone who's always eaten and will continue to do so, you do kind of wonder if that will be. It's funny. The fact that you see chefs everywhere, or you see food in non-food magazines, and you see all this sort of stuff, as someone who's always been engaged, it's just like, wow, it's almost too much for me, you know? Time to start knitting or something else that you can do at home.
I definitely feel that as well. I try and say I'm a culture writer who deals with food. Just because being another food writer living in Brooklyn, it's almost cliche at this point. I do think there are some aspects of this culture that won't last, and I don't think that, you know, chefs will continue to be the most important people in the country in 15 years.
Right.
Hopefully, it's a pretty great moment we're in.
Fantastic, yeah.
But I do think that some of these, this return to eating traditionally, these foods that we used to eat and learning how to make them, I think this is a response to the 20th century and how we used to eat and how we didn't always... Yeah, the 20th century is almost an embarrassment, I feel like, in the food world, and we got to move past Wonder Bread and Kraft, and I mean, I think pickles are an incredible metaphor for that, for taking it back.
Well, one of the things you mentioned makes me think about also our history. If you look beyond food, the immigrant moment, late 19th century, early 20th century, that in the form of becoming American, all these people from all over, part of what they gave up were these close identities to foods that they ate. I mean, it wasn't just that progressively prepared foods came in and took that away, but that's, as you said, with bacon and pork, that's sort of what it was to be American. This ham sandwich was a mark of something, and pickles and all those sorts of things, again, you know, it's taken us 100 years to appreciate them, because for a long time we wanted to forget that we ate anything like that and just stick to Wonder Bread. And, you know, I these things are always maligned, but they've actually served a purpose. I mean, even in some of the conversations we're having lately about the food system we have today was developed to create some very specific issues from 70 years ago that are no longer issues, and so we have the luxury to consider it broken and fix it in a certain way. And I feel the same sort of thing with this reclaiming of old food ways.
I think that's definitely true. I was just reading something the other day. I just can't recall, but it was about these second or third generation Chinese immigrants in America who now are requesting to eat those foods, or eating the foods that their parents ate growing up. And for the first time feeling comfortable
right.
With that, whereas their parents quickly wanted to
forget
eat American.
It, right.
And now these kids are able to bring the Chinese foods that they, you know, the parents grew up eating and they didn't really grow up eating to school and not be embarrassed about it,
right,
and not be shamed.
Mm-hmm, not be made fun of.
You know, it's funny, I call it the line of the ham sandwich, what you referenced, this line that, I did a lot of reading of memoir in Enlightenment Europe, Jewish memoir, and a lot of these memoirists will all talk about their move from kind of backwards Jewish life into enlightened Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the final moment in a few of these books is always the eating of the ham sandwich. And it's almost internalizing this other culture, and internalizing the forbidden, internalizing this symbol of openness and cosmopolitanism. And I do think about that in the U.S. as well. And I think there's incredible stories that are out there of people needing to adapt culturally, you know, adapting culturally to American life and eating American. And even my own family, I didn't grow up eating knishes and latkes all the time. I ended up eating casseroles and, you know, tuna quiche and these other American foods. And I myself have returned in some ways to how my parents grew up eating at home. Returning to pickles.
Right.
I'm writing an article about knishes, and I'm going around New York and eating knishes everywhere. And I have this love for the knish now. And it reminded me of eating a few knishes with my grandparents when I was older,
right.
And these blintzes. And almost I myself now feel so comfortable being able to embrace those foods of my own imagined past, you know, of my family's past. But I didn't grow up that way, but I still feel connected to it.
Right. Well, as I said, we could talk forever. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being here. Check out porkmemoirs.com. It's a fascinating read. Share your story and share it with other people. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. Next week, we'll be talking about visual tastes with a wonderful food stylist, Dolores Custer, and a great food photographer whose name just escaped me, Jamie Tiampo, excuse me. We're good friends. You can always download these shows on iTunes. Look for the podcast, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Jones Family Farms is a 400-acre working farm offering quality agricultural products all year round, from fresh summer berries to Christmas trees in the winter, and an award-winning winery that is open from April to December. The reach of the Jones Family Farms is hard to capture, from their advocacy work through the Working Lands Alliance to ongoing classes in the Harvest Kitchen. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. Visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com for more information.